Welcome to The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edward Willis, and this episode's guest, Larry Correa. Welcome to The World Shapers, the podcast where I talk to science fiction and fantasy authors, like myself, about their creative process. And yes, I also write science fiction and fantasy. My name is Edward Willett, and my latest book is A World Shaper. It's my ninth novel for Daw Books. It launches a new series called The World Shapers, and it is no coincidence that the title of this podcast matches so closely the title of the new series. The books take place in a labyrinth of shaped worlds, which are worlds that have been shaped by individuals who now live within them, the Shapers. The first book takes place in a world very much like ours, with a few differences, but Shauna Keyes, who seems to be an ordinary woman living in this world, discovers through the agency of a mysterious stranger who shows up in her world that she is, in fact, the shaper of that world. And not only that, but she now has to flee for her life because a mysterious adversary has entered her world and is rapidly turning it against her. So the first book takes us across this world, which is something like ours, but not entirely, as she attempts to escape into the next world to fulfill the quest she's been given by the mysterious Carl Yatzer to visit as many worlds as possible and capture the knowledge of those worlds, the Chachma, it's called, and take all of that to Ygrere, the mysterious woman at the center of the labyrinth, the one who has made it possible for shapers to enter these worlds. It's a great premise because it's going to allow me to write stories set in all kinds of worlds. And in fact, the second book, Master of the World, which I'm just in the process of finishing revisions on as this goes live, is set in a Jules Verne-inspired steampunkish kind of world. So I'm having a lot of fun with that one. The Master of the World will be out this fall in September 2019. World Shaper, which is already out in trade paperback and just recently came out in audiobook, will be out in mass market paperback in August. So lots of opportunity to get in on the ground floor of this new series. And I hope that you as a reader, if you are a reader, and I presume you probably are, you might not be listening to this if you aren't, will enjoy that series as much as I have enjoyed launching it. I hope that it will go on for many books to come. That would be great. The other book of mine I'd like to mention off the top here, just before we get into this episode, is Paths to the Stars. This is a collection of my short fiction, and it was just shortlisted for two Saskatchewan Book Awards. It's shortlisted for the Regina Book Award for Best Book by a Regina Author. I live in Regina, Saskatchewan, Canada. And is also nominated, shortlisted, I should say, for the Fiction Award for the Best Work of Fiction. So you can find Paths to the Stars, if you're curious, at any bookstore. You can order through Amazon or your favorite online bookstore, or you can visit shadowpawpress.com. You can find it there, or my own online bookstore, which is edwardwillettshop.com, two T's on Willett. That's where you will find all of my books available that I have copies of, and you can buy autographed copies there if you so desire. And of course, you can find out about all of the books that I've written and a bunch of other stuff about me if you visit my main website, which is edwardwillett.com, edwardwillett.com. Okay, that's the obligatory self-promotion off the top of the podcast. Let's get on to the meat of this episode. My guest is Larry Correa. Larry Correa is the New York Times best-selling, award-winning author of the Monster Hunter International series, the Grim Noir Chronicles trilogy, the Saga of the Forgotten Warrior epic fantasy series, which we'll be talking about particularly in this episode, the Dead Six thrillers, those are all from Bain Books, and also writes novels set in the War Machine game universe. A former accountant, military contractor, firearms instructor, and machine gun dealer, Larry has been a full-time author for several years, and his first novel, Monster Hunter International, was originally self-published. He's now published in seven countries. Larry lives in northern Utah with his, quote, very patient wife, end quote, and four children. So, Larry, welcome to The World Shapers.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Now, we met very, very, very briefly at Dragon Con this year, or last year, I guess, which was My very first Dragon Con, I found it a bit overwhelming. There's a lot of people there.
Oh, yeah. It's a giant nerd Mardi Gras.
I was at your panel on, I made a point of sitting in the front row, actually, at the panel on monsters that you were on.
Wow.
Which
cool.
Was a very good panel. And then introduced myself and asked if you'd be interested in being on the podcast. And you said yes. And we finally gotten around to it. So very glad to have you. I've enjoyed your books and looking forward to talking to you about them. We're going to talk specifically about the Saga of the Forgotten Warrior, your fantasy. I guess it's going to be a trilogy? Or longer.
Well, I originally pitched it as a trilogy to Tony Weisskopf, my publisher, and she's you know, Tony knows this stuff very well, and so I gave her kind of a plot outline for the trilogy, and she came back and she gave me a book deal for 3 books, but then she said, you know, there's no way in the world you're going to fit this into 3 books, right? So, yeah, well, originally it was a trilogy, but there's probably going to be more than that. Well, I'm working on the third one right now.
We'll call it a series then. First book of that was Son of the Black Sword, and so we'll talk about how that all came about a little later. But to start with, I'd like to talk with my guests about how they got started doing this crazy thing that they did. So I guess take us back into the mists of time. And first of all, where did you grow up and how did you first get interested in science fiction fantasy as a reader and then as a writer? How did that all come about? You have a rather unusual path to publication.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm originally from El Nido, California, which is a little tiny town in Merced County, which is in the San Joaquin Valley. It's the part of California that's more cows than people. And that's where I'm from. And I grew up on a farm in the middle of nowhere. And we were really poor, but there was a little tiny library, a little tiny county library. And I was a nerdy kid. I loved reading books, and I read every single thing they had there and then discovered interlibrary loan. I was always that awkward kid that read books on the bus and read books during recess, and I just always loved to read.
Yeah, I know, and that kid. I was that kid.
I think that's most of us. And, you know, but I grew up in Italy. It was a pretty rough place. We were, poor dairy farmers and a lot of hard manual labor, and It was a lot of fun, but I read to escape, and I discovered science fiction and fantasy pretty early on. I mean, I started out with westerns because, my dad didn't read. He didn't appreciate books. He didn't like books. He thought books were kind of a sissy activity. That was just kind of how I was raised. But I got a pass on westerns, and so I actually started out with Louis L'Amour. Mm-hmm. My dad thought westerns were manly and cool and tough, so westerns were okay. But then actually, I think one of the first fantasy books I ever came across was Sword of Shannara with Terry Brooks, the old classic, and discovered that. I think that was my gateway drug to fantasy.
Well, that's interesting, starting with Sword of Shannara, and of course it was very much in the mold of Tolkien, but you came to it first instead of Tolkien.
Yeah. So I came to Tolkien later. I went backwards on that, and no, I mean, I got to meet Terry Brooks in person for the first time like 5 or 6 years ago, and I think I really nerded out pretty hard. I kind of got into that, and I read a lot of different things, various genres. I love reading different genres. I pretty much wound up as a fantasy guy just because that was what I was good at, and that's what I enjoyed writing the most. But I'm kind of a multi-genre kind of guy myself. I write in a bunch of different genres too, but fantasy is my primary thing, and I love it.
So when did you actually start putting your own words on paper and telling your own stories?
Oh, I was really young, actually, when I would get books of paper, and I would illustrate the stories too. And my mom actually saved some of these. So after I die, my wife will probably be able to sell these on eBay to my fans for a lot of money. But, you know, there's like really goofy little adventure stories with cartoons and stuff. Then my first attempt at seriously writing, I was in college. And at the time I was on a Tom Clancy kick. I had been reading just a ton of techno thrillers. And I decided, very first book I ever tried to write was actually a thriller. And it was terrible. It just wasn't very good. It's the first thing you try to write has training wheels, and it was terrible. I didn't know what I was doing. And that got shelved. And then I graduated college, and about 10 years, I went off and had a career and a family and worked hard and didn't really have time for it. And then I decided to give it a shot again in the mid 2000s. I started, at the time, the kick I was on was horror movies. And, I'm also a gun nut. I was a firearms instructor. And so I took two things I knew a lot about, horror movies and gun nuttery, and I stuck them together. And that's where my Monster Hunter series came from. And that book actually did really super well. That's, it's still doing well. So that's kind of how I started writing. So I guess I've always kind of been a writer, but I took a decade off to be a grown up.
Did you do anything in the way of, you know, writers groups or classes or anything in all that time? I know you didn't.
No.
You certainly didn't study at university. You became an accountant eventually.
Yeah. Yeah, I got my degree in accounting and did a bunch of things like that. I was an auditor, and then I was in the gun business for a long time, and then I was a military contract accountant. I did that for many years. But the thing is, I never did any writing-related stuff other than business writing. I wrote nonfiction because I actually wrote technical articles and review articles for gun magazines. And I wrote articles about, I guess best way to put this for a non-gun nut audience is tactical stuff because I was an instructor. And so I wrote things like that, but I never wrote any fiction during that time. I never had any training. I took the minimal number of English classes required to graduate. I was never in any writers groups or anything of that nature. I just read a lot. So I kind of learned by doing, I guess.
That, in your words, very bad thriller that you wrote. Did you share it with anybody, you know, and at least get a hint that perhaps you could, you could tell a story that people were interested
in? A handful of friends. And they actually, like, people liked it and they really enjoyed it. And they were kind of surprised that I was literate. you know, being the big, dumb knuckle dragon farm kid, they're like, wow, this is actually really good. But yeah, it just wasn't up to snuff. And, it's funny though, because there's no such thing as wasted writing. We always save even our worst stuff has little nuggets in it. So later on, when I was doing the Dead Six series with Mike Cooper, I stole pretty much every line of dialogue, every cool character, everything that was neat or good from that first book, I stole. And so it later on wound up in, you know, other books. But, it was good practice. But no, I never had any sort of organized group or anything. Just I would hand it out to friends and said, hey, you know, check this out. That was about it.
See, I wrote novels in high school that I showed to my friends, and they, you know, oh, this is really good. And of course, like you, I look back at those now and I think, no, actually they weren't, but at least I learned that, you know, people were interested in reading what I wrote. And that kind of, was what drove me into doing it. And, you're talking about writing the nonfiction. I was a journalist myself, so I wrote, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of words of nonfiction. I would say probably, and let's see if you would agree with me, that even though you're not writing fiction, the mere act of putting that many words together, even if it's for gun magazines or whatever it is, still contributes to your writing improving. Would you say that's fair?
Oh, I would say that's totally fair. Like I said, there's no such thing as wasted writing. Honestly, I think anything that you're doing that you're having to put together a coherent narrative is good training. And it's just good practice, just stringing words together, wordsmithing. It's all useful. And, maybe not Twitter.
the great Twitter novel has yet to be written.
I don't know if I want to read it. That's
Now, Monster Hunter International, it wasn't published by a traditional publisher to begin with, was it?
No, it was not. I'm with Bayon now, and I've been with them for about 10 years this year. And but originally it was self-published, because what happened is I wrote this book, and best way to describe it is, think, you know, X-Files meets the Expendables. Okay, so it's all the tropes of various horror movies and, you know, Lovecraft mythos, because I love Lovecraft and, you know, all that's in there. Only the people, it's not a horror story, it's an adventure story, because the characters are not, you know, typical horror movie characters who scream and run and get eaten. They're, you know, my people. And so they were a bunch of gun nuts and military contractors and combat vets and all those people. And so they dealt with all these monster problems like my people would. You know, the running joke is, if you made a horror movie about the average gun nut, it'd be a really short horror movie. But So I did this, and I tried to sell it in the traditional manner. So back in those days, this predates the ebook revolution and, you know, Kindle and all that. So I tried to sell it the traditional way, you know, by getting it to agents and then, you know, putting, you know, sending it to slush piles. And I collected, it was just over 100 rejections.
Ooh.
I had a shoebox full of rejections. And basically, I had a lot of people, you know, agents, well-known agents come back to me and say, hey, this is really good. This is really fun. But I don't think it's sellable. I don't see a market for this. And, well, I was a businessman. You know, I was a fairly successful businessman at this point. I understood marketing. I understood markets. I understood audiences. And I'm looking at this, and I'm thinking, you know, I think there is a market for this. It might not be a market that, you know, regular Manhattan Publishing understands, but I think there's a sufficient number of people out here that I could sell this book. So at that point, self-publishing was kind of more of a vanity thing. And, it, you know, you didn't have ebooks. You had $25 print-on-demand paperbacks, which that's a pretty hard sell. But I had an audience already from my from some of my other work, and I was a moderator on a couple big internet gun forums. And so I actually did some online fiction for free with another guy named Mike Coopery, who I later on wrote some novels with. A great guy, very good writer. And we put out, you know, this free online fiction, and people read it and they're like, wow, this guy can actually write fiction. This is pretty good. And so then I launched my $25 print-on-demand paperback, and it actually did really extremely well, which in, you know, those days of self-publishing was, you know, it was like if you sold, you know, 3,000 to 5,000 copies of a print-on-demand paperback, that was huge. It's nothing like print-on-demand, you know, nothing like it is today. Very different. But it was actually a very big success. And Uncle Hugo's is this big independent bookstore in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Great bookstore, great guys. And one of their employees read this, or one of their former employees read this, and then passed it on to Uncle Hugo, or Don Bliley and Uncle Hugo's, who wound up printing out the Word document file on his printer and read the whole thing that night. And then he called Tony Weisskopf, who was the publisher at Bain, and said, you guys need to buy this book because I could sell the heck out of it. And that got Tony Weisskopf to take a look at it, and she thought it was great. And she, and at that point, you know, my self-published book was doing pretty good. But so she contacted me and made me an offer to buy it. And this is where it really is cool. So I had to discontinue the self-published version. I signed my contract, and but, you know, the way publishing schedules work, it wasn't going to come out for almost a year and a half. So what happened is for a year and a half, everybody talked about this great self-published book that they really, really liked, and to their friends, and their friends couldn't buy it because there were no more. And nothing makes somebody want something more than not being able to have it. So for a year and a half, everybody wanted to get their hands on this book, and no one could. So then when the actual Bain version came out, it was just mass market paperback. Back then, it was before I was in hardcover. Our little print run sold out in like the first 24 hours. It just exploded. And then so she did another print run, and it went nuts, and it was just instantaneously sold out. And so she did a third print run, and it went nuts too. But by that point, it kind of slowed off. But, you know, she'd given me a contract for a few more books at that point. So yeah, that's how my career got started, and I've been doing this for about 10 years now. That was back in 2009 is when the Bain version came out. And I'm at 21 novels now, I think, and a couple collections of short stories and a bunch of novellas and miscellaneous projects. So it's been really busy.
It's safe to say this is what you do full time now.
Oh yeah, yeah. I quit my accounting job about, I want to say, 5 or 6 years ago. So I've been a full time writer ever since.
Well, I have to say, I had run across mentions of Monster Hunter International. I think I was actually in the hospital for some reason, and I needed stuff to read, and I may have gotten it through was it in the Bain Free Library? That may have been where I got the first book.
It is, yeah. Once we had, I think, 3 or 4 books in the series, and they added the first one to the free library. So yes, for your listeners, you can get my first book for free. It's available on Bain.com, or you can download a free version for your Kindle on Amazon.
But be warned that was like a, you know, one hit and then you're hooked, at least in my case, because then I tore through all the others, and I've been keeping up with it ever since. So good job, Bain.
That's why we do it. Yeah, it's the we follow the crack dealer method of product distribution, where the first hit is free. The rest of the book costs. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. One of the things that I often get asked, and you know, I've asked, you're my, what, 18th or 20th interview or something in this podcast. And, you know, people always ask, well, how do you break in, or how did you get your first book published? And the thing is, it's different for absolutely everybody. So, you know, your story is fascinating, but it's probably not going to help anybody else break in.
Yeah.
Because it can't, it's not going to happen that way to anybody else.
Well, and technology changes so rapidly now too. So even though this was only 10 years ago for me, the entire method of how I got into it, doesn't even exist anymore, really.
Yeah.
And now self-publishing has become so easy that the challenge there is, I mean, yeah, anybody can self-publish and it's a snap, but you have to compete with the 100,000 other people that also self-published that month. It's super competitive, so it's very different than when I did it.
I did want to ask, and the reason is that my first book with Daw had been rejected by them and then through a roundabout way got accepted by them as a paperback. Had Bain, you said you had 100 rejections, had Bain rejected it once before it came back to them?
This is kind of funny. So actually what happened with them, because most of my rejections were from agents, and I also submitted directly to every publisher that would let you, Bain does a slush pile. So back in those days, you would just mail the manuscript to Bain, and they would have like a big pile in their office of typed manuscripts. And they would go through and read them, and then they would have their slush readers. So I did actually mail one. I did submit one to the slush pile. However, it disappeared or never arrived, because what happened was years later they were going through their old slush pile trying to find the original Monster Hunter I mailed them, just so they could have, because it's, you know, it's an international bestseller for them now. You know, we've got like a, you know, millions of books in print, and so they were trying to, like, you know, find this original photocopied manuscript that I had mailed them, and they could never find it. And so I don't know, it got lost at the post office. So no, I didn't ever actually get rejected by Bain.
Someday it'll turn up.
Yeah, I figured it'll show up on eBay when some postal employee finds it in the, you know, floorboards of his car. No, so that was a weird one right there. But no, I got rejected a lot. But this, you know, I always tell writers, I always tell aspiring writers, you know, you're going to get rejected. There's nothing wrong with that. Just keep going. I, you know, 100 sounds like a lot, but I'm not even in near the top. I want to say Laurel K. Hamilton got rejected like 250 times. And that was for her Anita Blake stuff, which has gone on to sell like 30 million copies, you know? But back then they did, that was before paranormal romance was really a thing. She's kind of like, you know, the godmother of that genre. And so publishers liked it and they just didn't know what to do with it. And so people were like, oh, I don't really know what, I don't know how I'd sell this. I don't know, you know, what genre is this? And, you know, urban fantasy was like a weird oddball thing back then, and paranormal romance didn't even exist. So they didn't know what to do with her. And now she is super, super successful. So, I, you know, you never know. You just got to keep throwing stuff out there to see what sticks.
Yeah, it's the, you know, it's, everybody hopes that that kind of a story will be theirs. And for most people, it isn't. But the possibility is always there. So that's what keeps a lot of writers going, I think.
Well, there's a lot of us, we show up and somebody's like, wow, it's like you're an overnight success. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it only took 5 years.
Well, yeah, in my case, it was before I had anything published fiction-wise. I'd been trying to sell for 15 years, I think, or something like that. My first book was using Microsoft Publisher for Windows 95. And my second book was using Microsoft Publisher for Windows 97. So it was like a series, you know, but not quite what I was interested in.
Yeah, I mean, we all come at it from different ways. There's no right answer. And it's funny because I go to these panels and stuff, and people always ask me, is like, what is the trick? Like, what is the secret? Like, dude, I wish I knew, because I would totally, like, you know, sell that.
Yeah, if I'd known, I wouldn't have taken so long to get to where I am. Well, we're going to talk about Saga of the Forgotten Warrior series, not trilogy. We'll start with talking, obviously we'll talk about the first book because it's hard to talk about the second book if you haven't read the first book, which I have, by the way. First book is called Son of the Black Sword, and maybe I'll let you give a synopsis because otherwise I'm liable to spoil something that shouldn't be spoiled.
No problem. Okay, so Son of the Black Sword is an epic fantasy. It's set in a world that's kind of loosely based on India, but I won't say too much about the setting. It's a world with really brutal caste systems, but it's not a religious society. In fact, religion has been banned for a very long time. But instead, they have a all-encompassing law, and everybody in the society has a place. The story is about the main character is a fella named Ashok Vidal, who is a magical super warrior. Think of this guy as kind of a roving magical Judge Dredd. Okay, this guy is the ultimate law enforcer in a land where the law is basically God. But the story is about him and what happens to him, because it turns out he is not who he thinks he is. And that's the thing about epic fantasies. You can't just over describe them without giving away the plot, but it's really awesome. It came out super good. I love it. It's done really well. Been very popular. The story is basically, I describe this guy as he's kind of a cross between the Punisher and George Washington. And it's the story of how he basically turns from this, like, you know, unflinching law enforcer to this saga is him becoming a human being. But these are people that have not had religion for a long time. Like I said, it's been banned, and the old gods are kind of, you know, meddling in the affairs of man once again. This is a world where the oceans are basically hell. So the culture is developed up around that. No, you don't want to be by the ocean. The ocean is bad news in this setting. It's a fun series. And so the first one is Son of the Black Sword, which came out a couple years ago. Did really well. It's my first foray into epic fantasy, or basically kind of. I'm a huge Robert E. Howard fan, so I kind of think of it as a sword and saucer, or sword and sorcery. But it's epic fantasy. The sequel is called House of Assassins, and that actually comes out right now. I think by the time this airs, I'll be on book tour for it. So that's number two. And then number three is called Destroyer of Worlds, and I'm working on that right now. That's actually what I was typing on when you called, or when you emailed me. So, yeah, it's the series is a lot of fun. I've really enjoyed it. It's a very dark setting. So as I say, fun, just put this in perspective. I'm a writer, so we have our ideas are fun are a little different.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I destroy planets for fun. So.
Yeah, exactly. No, this is I get to tackle a bunch of issues and have a lot of fun with it. But I'm not a heavy-handed message fiction kind of guy. I'm an action adventure guy. And if the theme sneaks in there, it's usually on accident. And don't worry, I always put the action scenes first.
So, what was the genesis of this? The seed from which this grew.
You know, this is really interesting because, you know, this is the funny thing about how ideas work. So many, many years ago, I was a panelist. When I was a new writer, I was a brand new writer. I was on a panel at a convention called LTUE, which is Life, the Universe, and Everything in Provo, Utah. And back then, it was held at the BYU campus, college campus. And I was the newbie writer, and I was on a panel with Lee Modestit, Brandon Sanderson, and Dave Wolferton, who, as you know, are three big-time very successful fantasy writers. And so I'm on this panel, and some college student in the audience had a question about something. I can't remember what the question is, and I had a really good answer for it. And so I started to answer the question, and this college student cuts me off, and he goes, no, you're just an urban fantasy writer. I want to hear from the epic fantasy writers. And I was like, you little bastard. And I sat down. I was kind of like torqued, right? It's like I said, I've only been a writer for a couple of years. And so as soon as the panel was over, I snagged Brandon Sanderson. And I was like, hey, Brandon, what makes something an epic fantasy? And so he's like, well, you know, it's got to have a lot of characters and a big giant plot and usually world-spanning events and a lot of history and world-building and that kind of stuff. I'm like, okay, cool. And so then I hooked up with Mike Kufri, who I've mentioned before, because Mike's one of my best friends and my co-author on my thriller series. And we're driving home and we start brainstorming. And actually, the epic fantasy that I came up with turned out to be the Hard Magic, the Grimnoir Chronicles, which is my Hard Magic series. So my first attempt at epic fantasy turned into 1930s alternate history superheroes.
Yeah, and I'd actually call that one science fiction. It really has a science fiction undercurrent.
Exactly. Well, But that was the genesis of my foray into epic fantasy. But some of the ideas I came up with, which were during this process, you know, brainstorming, a lot of this turned into a series which is actually very successful and critically acclaimed, and it's won the Audi for best audiobook, like 2 out of 3 novels. Did really good. It was like number 16 on Audible's top 100 audiobooks of all time. You know, so it's done really good. But the thing is, this is my first foray into epic fantasy, and it turned out not epic fantasy at all. So then the next year, I was actually, when I was working on Monster Hunter Alpha, I still at this point really wanted to tackle an epic fantasy just because I read them, I enjoyed them, and I hadn't written one. Because, like I said, my attempt turned out to be alternate history superheroes. So I was like, I'm going to write an epic fantasy. So while I was working on Monster Hunter Alpha, I always listen to music as I write. And I usually listen to movie soundtracks because, you know, they're instrumental. There's no words to, like, mess with me. So it's just, you know, music. And so I hadn't even seen the movie yet, but I had downloaded the soundtrack for Inception because I love Hans Zimmer. All right. So Hans Zimmer's awesome. So I was listening to Inception. There's a song called Waiting for a Train. And it's like this 8 minute long or 9 minute long song that starts really, really slow, and then it builds up to this just massive crescendo. And before the crescendo begins, there's actually this woman, there's some lyrics in this. This woman comes on and sings like one line in French. And having not seen the movie, I had no context at all, right? And so, but I was so struck by this song that I stopped writing the novel that I was working on, and I actually wound up writing this little, like, 2,000-word short scene that was just a fantasy setting set specifically to that song. And because, once again, I hadn't seen the movie, so I had no context of what it actually looked like, right? Or what it was actually for. Boy, I was off. I was nowhere near what the movie Inception was like. But so I wrote this one little scene, and if you read Son of the Black Sword, it's actually the scene where Ashok Vidal is returning home after he's learned the truth of his existence to confront his his aunt, basically. Mm-hmm. And so it turned into the dinner party scene, the dinner party knife fight scene. So that was actually the genesis of Son of the Black Sword. Was I was just inspired to write this one scene to correspond with this song. And then when I finished up this, I started brainstorming it out and really came up with a big plot. The Indian setting was actually kind of interesting because I'm not a crusader by any means. In fact, that stuff annoys the heck out of me. And this was before the whole big push for non-Western settings because you're supposed to or any of that stuff. I just thought it sounded interesting. I thought it sounded fun. Plus, I watch a lot of Bollywood movies. And so I was just looking at this like, you know, that would actually be really kind of a cool setting. And plus, I'd already been thinking through with that initial scene I did where I'd already, just off that, was using a setting with caste systems. So at that point, it made perfect sense to just kind of borrow heavily from Indian history and mythology for the setting. And so it just kind of expanded out from there. And I actually wound up expanding it out and borrowing from I won't get too into it, but like some other elements from like Southeast Asia and even East Africa. So I got to, you know, drug a bunch of stuff in there from that for inspiration. But then it kind of morphed into its own thing. And so that's where that came from.
You know, it would be cool. It'd be a Bollywood movie version of Son of the Black Sword. Don't you think you could have
one? Oh, my gosh. Well, because in my head canon, as I'm writing this, I always like to have like actors or people I actually know playing various characters. That way, as I write them, it helps me keep them consistent. So Akshay Kumar, in my head, is Ashok. Oh. Ashok looks like Akshay Kumar. So he's been in a lot of movies. You've probably seen him, you know. And so I do that. So if they were like to make a movie, that'd be great. They'd have to add some musical numbers.
I was going to say the musical numbers would be interesting, but
in fact, my daughter, my oldest daughter, who's a writer also, she's watched a lot of these movies with me, and she's at one point where she's saying that'd be funny if they made a Bollywood version of Son of the Black Sword. And my daughter goes, no, Ashok don't dance. This is not a man who would dance. He's not a man given to frivolity.
She definitely has a point. So you talked a little bit about bringing all that, all those various things together. Was there a lot of research involved at this point then, or did that come along as you developed the plot? Or
I kind of that goes in spurts, because you know there's always the ever widening wiki spiral that all authors we tend to do as we're researching. No, so I did the basic plot outline first. I'm an outliner.
That was my next question.
I'm definitely an outliner. So. And plus, I learned my lesson. On my earlier books, I would outline, but I didn't necessarily keep like a series Bible, which when you're only one or two or three books into a series, that's not a big deal. But like a Monster Hunter, I'm, you know, seven books in with three spinoffs and a short story collection. So all of a sudden, this universe has gotten so big that, you know, I didn't originally have a universe guide for it. And so what I'm trying to remember is like, whoa, did I say where this person is from? Wait, is this guy left-handed? Did I ever see what color this person's eyes are? All that little stuff.
Yeah, starts to pile up.
Really, yeah, it does. It piles up. So what I did from the beginning for this series is I had my outline, but then I also have a separate world guide. Especially, you know, when you're writing urban fantasy, a lot of stuff, you don't need a world guide because it's just, you're just taking our existing world and inserting stuff into it. So I don't need to like, have a description of the, you know, the city of Chicago. It's just Chicago, right? But for this, when you make up every single city, every single place, every single family, every single cultural thing, you have to have some constant reference. And so down to like, you know, the calendar and how, you know, what are the names of the days of the week and the days of the month and, you know, what are the names of the month of the year and how does the calendar work and all this stuff. And so I try not to worry too much about all that stuff up front because it messes with you and it slows you down. So I outline the story first. When I say outline, I'm talking maybe 4 or 5 pages, maybe 8 or 10 pages tops for a book. I'm not a super religious outliner. It's a very, like, loose outline, and then I'll jump in, I'll start writing, and then when I come to something that I need to stop and research, if I'm on a roll, I'll just mark it. For me, my mark is always XXX, because then I go back and I control F and search for XX, every instance of XXX. That tells me this is something I need to, like, figure out or research.
Yeah, I use that, too, because there's no way it shows up by accident.
Exactly. Yeah, you're never going to find that on the middle of a word on accent. Yeah, so I put that in. Well, I guess if you're writing porn, I mean, that could happen. But luckily, that's not an issue. So, I mean, I'll put that. So if I'm not on a roll and I come up with something, then I'll stop and I'll go and I'll do research on it and, like, figure out how I'm going to do it. Then I'll add that to my world guide and I'll just go ahead and write. But if I'm on a roll and I don't want to stop to go figure out how, you know, calendars work or how does, you know, agriculture in the northern provinces work, I'm just going to put XXX. I'm going to keep plowing ahead. And then later on, when I'm stuck or bored or whatever, or what I'm at, I'll flip back. And then that's when I'll do my research. I guess I do a minimal amount of research up front for the outline and for the opening. And then I just go.
And of course, research has become much more easy than it was pre-internet and pre-Google and all these wonderful tools we have now.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, even in the 10 years that I've been doing this, it's gotten way easier. And, you know, 10 years ago, we did have the internet. I mean, it wasn't that long I've been doing this. But yeah, it's funny, you know, it's interesting too. I find that research, especially for fantasy novels, is super helpful. Because it just opens up so many other corridors in your brain that you otherwise hadn't thought of.
My example of that was, I have a book under a pseudonym, E.C. Blake. I wrote a trilogy called The Masks of Agrima, and part of it is set in a mine, and I needed some way for them to get up and down in the mine. And I thought, well, ladders are boring. And then I did some research and found this thing called a man engine, which is driven by water and reciprocating beams, and two sets of platforms go up and down, and as they go up and down, they meet momentarily, and you can step from one platform to the next and get carried down. And so that made its way in, and it made the whole scene more interesting and gave me all sorts of things that I could do. So, yeah, that sort of thing happens all the time.
Yeah, I love that stuff.
Now, what does your actual writing process look like? Do you write in longhand, for example?
No. My handwriting is awful.
I have talked to a few authors who do, which blows my mind, but some people still do it.
Yeah, Marco Clues writes everything originally with just a nice ink pen and a moleskin notebook. And I'm like, I don't know how he does that. No, I type. I was actually mentioning it to you earlier. I didn't know if this program we're using right now would work because I have an 8-year-old laptop that I've just never bothered to replace.
As long as the hamsters run fast enough, it'll be fine.
Well, I mean, all I really use my computer for is Wikipedia, Facebook, and typing. So, I work in pretty much normal, ever since I quit my day job, I work in like a normal work day. So I'm not a morning person. I don't try to force myself to work early in the morning just because my brain doesn't work that way. So about, 8:30 or 9 o'clock, I will usually drift into my office. I work from home. I have a nice office, and I'll go in here and I'll usually write until about lunchtime, and then I'll take a break for a little while to eat lunch. Unless I'm on a roll, then I eat while I type. Then I work until usually about 3:30 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. By then my imagination is starting to peter off, unless, again, I'm on a roll. Because, if you're having one of those days where you're on a roll, you just keep working, and I'll work until, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night. If I have a deadline, I work however long I need to work. I did a 16-hour day last week. I have about 2 weeks ago, because I had to do the short story, Testimony of the Traitor, Rutul, and I had forgotten about that. So I was up on my deadline, and I had to do a 5,000-word short story that day. And so I did, and I wound up working until, 8 o'clock at night, and the story was almost done. It was pretty good. And then I went to bed, and I lay there, and it was about 11:30 or midnight. I was still awake because I was so in the zone. And so I had to get back up, and then I finished the story writing until about 2:30 in the morning. Which is always scary. Cause I have a rule of thumb. You don't write after midnight, because what happens is then you check it the next day and it's crap. but this time I checked it and it was actually really good. And I was like, okay, perfect. But normally, the vast majority of the time, I'm a 9 to 5 kind of writer. I actually take weekends off now, which is amazing. Because for the first half of my writing career, I had a day job. And it wasn't just like a wimpy day job. It was actually it was a high level management finance management kind of job with I was the finance guy for a military contracting company. It was a high pressure job. It was a lot of hours, a lot of brain, a lot of hard work, a lot of math. And so I would do that all day, and then I'd come home and I would write for a couple hours at night, and then I would usually do most of my writing on the weekends. So all day Saturday and Sunday would just be these marathon writing days. And it's kind of funny because back then I had this goal that I would try to write 10,000 words a week, which, you'd never, that's a good goal, but I didn't always get it. But I would try. And which is funny because my goal still today, now that I do this full time, is still 10,000 words a week. The difference is life is much nicer now. Well, and also the big thing is that old stuff that I would cram in 10,000 words a week, here and there, writing at my lunch hour, writing late at night, writing all day Saturday. That stuff, it was funny because I would write all that and then I would have to edit it way more. I'd spend a lot more hours editing it because it just wasn't as good. Now I'll try to write 10,000 words in a week and I, just do my, 8 to 5. And then, but then when I go to edit it, my editing passes are actually way cleaner. And I don't spend nearly as many hours editing as I used to, which is good because writing is fun. Editing is work.
And that's actually the next question is, what does your revision process look like once you have that draft? You've mentioned that, you might mark things with XXX that you have to go back and flesh out later. So what does your revising process look like?
Usually what I do is, so I'll finish the first draft, and I'm one of those guys that if I'm stuck on a scene, I'll just mark it and move to the next scene. I don't like killing momentum because I've gotten to a hard part. A lot of people, they'll freeze up and they'll get stuck on a scene forever, and I think that's just the kiss to death. I mean, skip that, go to the next one you want to do. So when I get to the end of the book, I have to go back and fill in those scenes that I skipped. Or parts I skipped, or sometimes it's just like I skipped a paragraph because I didn't feel like explaining how something worked. So I go back and I fill all that stuff in, and usually it's a lot easier when you do that because by then you've written past that scene, so you know absolutely what must happen. Mm-hmm. That's why these guys who write longhand on paper, I'm like, I stand in awe because that is not how my brain works. Mm-hmm. And then I'll go through, I'll clean all that stuff up. I'll usually do a clean pass where I'll read it from beginning to end. I'll usually do that once or twice. And then, this is very important. I have a group of alpha readers now. These are people that I trust. And just these are various authors and friends of mine that I've got to, over the years. And also a lot of times technical experts. Like, so in this case, I'm writing a book with a lot of sword fighting. I'm not a sword fighting expert. I'm a gun expert, but I'm not a sword guy. And so I have a couple people that are, you know, modern or Western martial artists or Eastern martial artists or professional sword people. And I send it to them. And then I give it about a month. During that month, I will not look at this manuscript at all. I will walk away from it. Because what happens is I need to get some distance between me and the manuscript. Because if I keep reading a book, I'm too close to it. There's stuff that's in my head that's not necessarily on the page, mm-hmm. but it's in my head, so I don't catch it. So during that month, I'll go work on another book. I will go outline other projects. I'll go work. That's usually like I've written like 50 short stories now, and I think most of my short stories have been written between novels like this. So during that month, I will go do all sorts of other stuff. Then I will go back. I will read everything the alpha readers had to say about it, and then I will start again, and I will read it from beginning to end. And now I have some distance between me and the book. I will catch errors. I will catch mistakes. I'm like little things. I'll improve them just because a lot of that stuff, when you're too close to a manuscript, you can't see this stuff. You got to get some distance so you can have a clean eye. And then after that, it goes to my real editors. I've had several different editors with Bayon, and it just depends on which book and which series. And they've all been awesome. And they just take their feedback and incorporate it. So it's
Who's the editor? Who's the editor on these books, the Saga of the Forgotten Warrior books?
Well, this is interesting because actually these have been popular, so I've had multiple people have joined in on this. So Tony is our overall publisher, but then Jim Minns and also Tony Daniel have been my editors on this series.
What kind of notes? What kind of notes do you get back from them?
Actually, apparently I'm one of their favorites because I'm easy to edit. I'm not one of those sensitive artist types, so I'm pretty much open to anything. And usually they'll tag stuff and they'll be like, you know, hey Larry, look at this. A lot of times they'll just let me solve. They know I'm pretty good at solving a problem. So if like a scene doesn't work, they'll just put a note that hey, I don't understand what's going on here. And they'll just kick it back to me and I'll go over it. Very seldom have I ever had to make any major changes in edits. But just to give you an idea, like, so in House of Assassins, the one that's coming out right now, the sequel to Son of the Black Sword, the biggest edit in there was actually the chapter that I opened with was originally like chapter 3. And I opened with like chapter 2 was originally the opening of the thing. And Jim read this and he loved the book. But he's like, you know, I just think this other chapter that you have later on, I think it's just a stronger opening. He's like, I think if you open with this chapter instead of this one, it would be shorter. Now, I'd have to change some stuff around the chronology to do that, but I looked at it, you know. And the key to being edited is you got to be humble and don't be a prideful jerk about it because, you know, your editors are smart people too. And I looked at this and, you know, Jim was right. It was spot on. I mean, he was very correct. That other chapter made for a much cooler, more interesting opening. You know, so stuff like that. Well, my favorite edit that I ever got was actually in one of my Monster Hunter books. It was from Tony Weisskopf. And Tony is a hilarious editor. So this scene, for whatever reason, just didn't work. And so the note on the scene says, the note at the top of the page literally says, "This scene sucks. Make it not suck." And, you know, I looked at it and she was right. And so I did. She didn't need to tell me how to fix it. She just said, "This doesn't work. Make it work." And I did. So I've had really good editors. I've been really lucky there. They've been pretty awesome.
I like to point out to writers that, you know, who are worried about being editing that, especially if you're at the big house like Bayon or my publisher, Daw, you know, my editor, Sheila Gilbert, who's been in the business for 30 some years now.
She's awesome. Yeah.
And they have seen more stuff than you have in the field and know, you know, They know when things aren't working, and they have a pretty good feel for what does work. So, yeah, I'm very humble when it comes to being edited.
One of my favorite editing stories, just to put this in perspective for most authors, is, you know, a good editor is mostly there for suggestions. You know, it's your story. A bad editor takes over and makes you rewrite it according to their every whim. And that's just bad editing. You know, that's not a good fit. But my favorite editing story, just to illustrate how a good editor works, is in one of my books, I have this scene where it's from the bad guy's perspective, and she's there, and, you know, it's just kind of this lonely scene, and she's doing evil things, and it's just to show that she's like an evil, messed up person. And then at the end, she gets this cupcake out of her backpack and puts a candle in it, because it turns out today, this day that she's doing all the evil stuff, is her birthday. So my editor read this scene, and he said, no, this is what you do. How about open with the cupcake and the candle and her singing happy birthday to herself, and then you back up to how you got there? And it just, so it's just, all I did was move like two paragraphs, but all of a sudden it made the scene like 1,000 times cooler. You know, so that's what a good editor does, you know? They just kind of help you massage stuff to make it better.
Well, we are getting close to the end here, so we will move on to the big philosophical questions I like to ask.
Sweet.
Yeah. This podcast is called The World Shaper, and The World Shapers, I should say. And yes, that's partly because my latest novel is called World Shaper.
Nice.
Notice how I eased that in there. But I guess the question I like to ask authors is, obviously we all shape, we shape our fictional worlds. Do you ever have, you've said you're not, you know, you're not focused on pushing a message by any stretch, but do you still hope that in some way you shape, if not the world per se, that might be a little grand, but at least have an impact on your readers in some fashion?
I do. Yeah, actually. And this is a really interesting one as a writer. You know, it's interesting how we hear from people all the time, and I don't like to share these stories, but I'll speak in general here. But we hear from readers all the time where somehow something we wrote touched them. Where, you know, they're going through like a hard time and we cheered them up, or, you know, they lost a loved one and they were sad for a while, but the first time they laughed in a month was they read one of our books and it made them smile. It made them forget the suckiness of what was going on in their life right then. And so there's little moments like that. And, you know, I was on a panel one time with Jim Butcher and another author who I will not name. And somebody asked this question. And Jim was very classy. And he says, you know what? You know, I've had a lot of my readers tell me I've improved their life, or I've helped them out of a tough spot, or you know, I cheered them up. But those aren't my stories to tell. Those are theirs. And I was like, you know, that was so classy. And I really respected that, because then the next author then went on this really long-winded story about how he saved the day and how he was so super important. And I just remember sitting there thinking, yeah, Jim's answer was way classier. No, but as far as like message, I tend to write about, I like writing about heroic people. I like writing about individuals, you know, brave, rugged individuals who don't fit in, who try to do the right thing. I'm old fashioned. I do believe in good and evil, and I like when the good guys succeed. I like when the good guys fight. I mean, they don't always succeed, because, you know, bad guys got to win sometimes too, or there's no tension. But, you know, I like good versus evil. I like these big epic struggles. You know, one thing I really enjoy, and this was kind of like my point in the Grimnor Chronicles, was I was writing about these people that were facing all these hard odds, and they were fighting against kind of this like totalitarian government. And part of that was like, you know, the big question in that series was, do the people own the government, or does the government own the people? Because these were, you know, it was a very American 1930s book, but it was like the big philosophical question. In Son of the Black Sword, you know, I'm writing about these people with these really brutal caste systems and this law where everybody something people keep saying is every man has a place, because in the society, everybody has what's expected of them. And if you go outside of what's expected of you, that's trouble. And so I'm writing about the people that are the oddballs, the people who don't fit in, the people who, you know, they're bringing up crazy, crazy ideas like liberty or freedom and how just insane that is. So I don't know. I love touching on that stuff. I love entertaining people. So if I can accomplish anything, it's, you know, just to give people a good time, you know, and make them happy, cheer them up, give them some cool, fun action adventure. And, you know, if I brighten somebody's day, then I did my job. I guess that's how I look at it. I had this conversation one time with Toni Weisskopf, and I was saying basically what I just said, and she kind of shot me down because she takes a very different outlook on that. You know, 'cause she's primarily a science fiction person, and she says the job of science fiction authors is to teach people to dream big so they can, like, you know, try to achieve these great things. And then the job of the fantasy authors is to make people heroic enough to do it. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was kind of cool.
Well, and bringing it back from, you know, effect on readers to you, why do you do it? What do you think drives any of us to write and to make up stories?
Well, on the very first, like, most base level, I love getting paid. One of the running jokes on my blog when I'm giving writing advice, I'm like the prophet of capitalism, man. I'm all about, hey, we tell good stories, you know, readers like it, they buy our books. But honestly, a big part of it is I just like telling stories. I've always been a storyteller. I was always that kid with the big dramatic story. You know, I'm always the guy that was, you know, just telling everybody else what's going on, telling jokes, telling tall tales, you know, campfire stories, whatever. Oh, speaking of which, when you wind up, when you get drafted to be like a scoutmaster and you go on like a camping trip, and you know, you do the thing where you tell the scary stories to scare the teenagers, nobody is better at that than a professional fantasy author. I've written a lot of horror too, so man, I could scare the crap out of some teenagers around a campfire. I am legend for that. But no, I just like telling stories. I enjoy it. And the fact that I get to do this for a living and get to do this all day for fun is kind of amazing. It's like the coolest job in the world. I get to just, as my mom says, I love the way my mom phrased this one time, is I make crap up and tell lies for a living.
That's about it.
Thanks, Mom. That's a great way to put it. But yeah, no, it's awesome. It's the best job ever. I absolutely love what I do, and I'm super thankful that I've got fans that let me do this for a living. That I love my fans.
There's a famous, I live in Saskatchewan, there's a famous author from actually the same town that I used to be the newspaper editor in, Weyburn, W.O. Mitchell, and way back when I was young, which has been a while, there was a television program that had some of his stories had been dramatized, and he sort of did the Alfred Hitchcock thing and introduced it. But the title of the anthology series was The Magic Lie, which I think is a pretty good description of what fiction is.
Pretty much, yeah. That does fit.
Now, what are you working on now?
I'm working on a couple things simultaneously, because that's how my brain works. But I'm working on A Destroyer of Worlds, which is book 3 in the Saga of the Forgotten Warrior. And I'm also working on another novella, which is going to be an exclusive for Audible.com. It's my series. It's called Tom Stranger, Interdimensional Insurance Agent, which is my comedy series. It's narrated by Adam Baldwin, the actor from Firefly and The Last Ship. He's awesome. He's a great guy, great sense of humor. He does wonderful comedy. And so I'm doing that right now too. And so one really super serious project and one super silly project at the same time. We'll see how that works out.
And looking further down the road, what's still to come that you know about?
So after those two, I have later on this year, I have an anthology coming out called Noir Fatale, which was edited by me and a great writer named Casey Ezell. And Noir Fatale is a collection of science fiction and fantasy noir themed stories. You know, hard-boiled detectives, femme fatales, murder mysteries. We got some great writers in there. I got David Weber did a new Honor Harrington story for us. I got Laurel K. Hamilton did a new Anita Blake story for us. And we got a bunch of really super talented authors in there. I'll plug my daughter. My daughter actually sold me a story. It's in there. It's based in it's a Japanese ghost hunting detective story. and she, you know, she had to actually, you know, nepotism is a hell of a thing, but she did actually have to sell it to me, and this is really good. I have that coming out later this year, and then I also have another collection, a second volume of my collected short stories. It's called Target Rich Environment. So this is Target Rich Environment Volume 2, comes out at the end of the year. I forgot, Monster Hunter Guardian, the next Monster Hunter novel, which this one's a collaboration with Sarah Hoyt, it comes out in August. So this is the sixth book in the regular Monster Hunter series. It's about a character named Julie Shackelford, who's one of the main characters of the series, and it's awesome. This book is it's really cool. Best way to describe it is, you know, the movie Taken, Monster Hunter version of Taken. It's intense. It's really good.
So lots to look forward to then.
Yeah, there's. It's kind of funny. There's like a Larry Correa release every quarter this year. They keep me busy, but I like the work, so it works out well.
And if people would like to find you online, where would they look for you?
MonsterHunterNation.com is my blog, but I'm also on Facebook. I am no longer on Twitter. I got banned off of there. No, I'm still on Twitter too. I know I gave up on it. No, I'm on Facebook, just under Larry Correa. But the best place to find me is my blog, MonsterHunterNation.com.
Okay. Well, and that brings us, I think, to the end of the time. So thank you so much for being a guest on The World Shapers.
Well, cool. Thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
It's been great fun. So that brings us to the end of this episode of The World Shapers. And again, thanks to Larry Correa for being my guest. I enjoyed that chat a lot. I hope you did as well. Just a reminder that you can find The World Shapers online at theworldshapers.com. It's also on Twitter at The World Shapers. And also on Facebook, if you do a search for The World Shapers, you will come across it. I am also on Twitter at ewillett, E-W-I-L-L-E-T-T, and on Facebook at edward.willett. Again, two T's. And once again, my own website is edwardwillett.com. Two T's on Willett. You will find everything you could possibly want to know about me at that website. Thank you for joining me for this episode of The World Shapers. I hope that you will come back many times in the future to check out the many other great authors that I will be interviewing, people like Kevin Hearn, Kim Harrison, Fonda Lee. Those are just some of the ones that I already have lined up, and I'm working on many others. V.E. Schwab, actually, will be coming along very shortly as well. So I hope that you will come back many times, and I hope that you will also check out the many great interviews I've already done. Again, if you visit the website at theworldshapers.com, you can find a complete archive of all of the episodes. Go back and listen to as many as you like, and tell your friends and neighbors as well. That's it for this episode of The World Shapers. Once again, thank you for joining me. I will talk to you again soon. Bye for now.